Welcome to this episode of Wrecking Ball, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I am one of your hosts, Kyle, joined by my always favorite Lopez lover, Tim. How you doing?
I'm doing quite well. I have an appointment to get the first vaccine shot on Saturday, so I'm pretty excited. Nice.
Are you out of quarantine or the kind of semi-quarantine you were under?
Kind of. I guess it would technically be up Sunday. It's pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, it would require you to do anything different than you normally do.
Yeah, I'm not leaving.
Going to work and going home. So that's great news. I'm glad you brought that up because unfortunately I got some bad news for you, Tim. I always hate to do this to you.
What could that be?
Well, much like COVID, everything. Things change. We won't be able to talk about the episode of the George Lopez Show where Benny is still furious about her breakup with Randy. So she and Gina go to Thirsty's and talk about how they both think all men are bad. The next day, the factory was trash and everyone blames it on Benny because she's so mad about what Randy did. But in the end, they find out Benny was innocent and it was Jack who did it. I don't know who Jack is. I don't remember that episode. But we actually have a really good episode. I'm so excited about this one. We're going to be talking to writer, editor, a million things, Steve Fox, about a million of his amazing books. But specifically at the start, one of mine and Tim's favorite books of last year, Night Train, one of the TKO shorts. So thanks so much for joining us, Steve.
Thanks for having me. I wish you could have seen my face because I really, for a moment, thought I should have prepared some George Lopez information. And that's exactly when I stopped watching Nick at Night. So it would have been challenging for me.
Oh, when it came on? Yeah, that was like, it was what probably drove me away from Nick at Night. I was seeing every episode of the George Lopez Show.
When it looped to things that ran in my lifetime, I just couldn't stick with it.
Yeah, when it was like Full House on there and
That was too weird of a feeling for my late teens, early 20s to feel like Nick and Knight was catching up with me.
Now I don't even know if that's like a
it thing. Is because I saw on Twitter someone posted their lineup is now like Friends and some other show. Whoa. From 10 years ago.
So weird. The day program I run, we have like TV there, and at home we just have like all the streaming stuff. We don't have any like cable or anything, so it's so weird being like, I'll have downtime and I'll like turn on the TV and there's like TV shows on, and you have to like, I'm like, what the fuck is it? My kids don't understand commercials. It's like the weirdest thing. So I'm any regular listener of the show, and I mean, it's gonna be a broken record because it's all we talk about, like me and Tim adore horror comics, and on our end of the year episode we were talking about a lot of our favorite books of the year, and the TKO shorts and Night Train came up, and for me that is like legit one of having a newborn in the house. When I read it, it was like one of the scariest books I ever read, because they're like, I know it's terrible to say, and I think people with kids understand, but I understand how people shake babies to death, which is terrible to say, but it's like, sometimes it's like, what the fuck, like, what is going, stop crying, what is going on? And to like to tap into that, like, and then the payoff at the end, or the twist is amazing. So like, how did, I think the shorts, TKO is like one of the most unique, I think, publishers out there. But I think the shorts kind of came out of nowhere for a lot of people. And I think still didn't really kind of understand what they were. And then when people got them, they were all, every single one of them was fantastic. But I said Night Train was like the standout for me. How did that come about for you? And like kind of the understanding of like, how did that process come out, like writing a short comic for TKO?
Yeah, well, so a lot of things in my career feel like they are very interconnected and bounce around. So TKO is no exception. How that got started on my end was when James Tynan reached out to me about potentially editing the Department of Truth, which obviously happened. I am editing the book. I reached out to a couple freelance editors I knew to ask some general questions about what's it like working with Image, what's it like, you know, what kind of fees should I expect, stuff like that. And one of the people I reached out to was Sebastian Gerner, because Sebastian was a Marvel editor when I was an intern a full decade ago now. And we didn't know each other that well when I was at Marvel, but Sebastian's a very friendly guy. And I expected him to DM me back, like, you know, three sentences. But he scheduled a call with me, and we ended up talking for almost an hour about freelance editing, but also about, like, the state of the industry and how things are going for him at TKO, because Sebastian is the main editor there working with Z. And somewhere in the call, I made some sort of offhand joke about, like, yeah, I'm not trying to, you know, backdoor pitch you. But Sebastian was like, no, you can. You can if you want to. And I had heard that week from a friend who was going through the pitch process with TKO that they were soliciting these shorts, and that they were also branching out into doing illustrated prose, because at the same time that the shorts came out, they also put out a collection of short stories in that same wave. So that's how that all happened. And I ended up sending Z and Sebastian, I sent them 12 pitches. So very few people would recommend you doing something like that, but I've had times where I've done, like, the scattershot approach, because my thinking was, like, you know, Z's a very busy guy, and this may be my only chance to hook him on something. And if I send three ideas I love, but they're just not what he's looking for, then I might blow this. So I took a chance. I sent 12, and they liked several of them, and then we ended up settling on Night Train. And, you know, TKO popped up around the same time that a couple of other newer publishers popped up, but it was such a great experience working with them because, like, yeah, Z works in Hollywood, and sometimes there are negative connotations with that, but he really is a comic guy, and Sebastian has such a wealth of experience between Marvel and Image, and it was just, like, one of the most constructive, for being as short as it is, it was one of the most constructive development processes I've ever had as a writer. Because we really had the time to kind of refine the script and refine the idea, find the right artistic team. And actually, it's funny that you talk about the relevance of it to a newer father, because the original pitch was even darker than what the book turned out to be. But Sebastian had some good advice on how to pull it just a little bit back from the brink.
Yeah, it's like, there's the, what's the Scarlett Johansson movie, she's the alien. What am I blanking on?
Under the Skin?
Under the Skin.
Under the Skin, yeah. There's the scene where she leaves the baby as, like, the tide's coming in. As, like, that shit's, like, ruined for me now as dad. But so this was, like, just enough of, like, oh yeah, I could see that after.
Yeah, and on the so that was, like, how it came about practically, but the on the thematic side, one of my best friends, because I'm 31, I just turned 31. But when you live in the city, like, this is going to sound pretentious, but when you live in the city, it feels like everything starts later on that scale. Mm-hmm. Like, people have kids later, people get married later, because a lot of the people here are, you know, just doing the stupid New York stuff. But one of my first, like, really close friends had a baby. And that felt like a sea change in my personal circle, and just, like, one of those really stark reminders of getting older and things changing. So that I kind of drew on the secondhand experience. I mean, he loves the baby. The baby is right. Safe and taken care of. It's nothing like you see in Night Train. But witnessing that secondhand, it was what planted the seed in my mind.
Well, and I think you're able to capture, especially coming at it from kind of the first half of the thought process of a kid, which in itself is, like, the frustration of having to share the room, but also, like, the frustration of, like, having then to share your parents and watching kind of, like, the mom, like, deteriorate in the sense of, like, just always being tired and kind of, like, the where that's taking on this family and of no fault of, like, anyone in it. And, like, the kid doesn't even have, like you, the short time you were living with this family and this, like, this issue is, like, you're able to, like, the kid doesn't have, like, ill will to the kid, like, the baby almost. Like, it is just, like, a buildup of that, and then like to be able to kind of do that and then reverse fortunes as an adult and be able to kind of then drag that into that was, I think, like really good. And to be able to pull that off in so few pages is amazing as a kind of writer that you were able to do that.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think one of the interesting things to me in, I guess, in fiction in general, but in horror fiction especially, is when no one is necessarily clearly at fault for things that happen. Because I think in the real world, culpability is often shared, which is, I mean, so much of the past 4 years has challenged that notion when you just see like stark raving evil. But I think generally you end up with people who make complicated decisions for complicated reasons. And that was really how I approach Night Train. But also, I mean, I love the short fiction format. And I got so excited about TKO doing these because there's not often that much space in comics for short, contained stories. Like, yeah, I mean, Marvel and DC do really great anthologies, but those are starring characters that you can read hundreds of issues about. So the chance to do like truly standalone, self-contained short stories and to kind of break out of that mold of everything needing to be a 5-issue arc, elevator pitch, ready to go to your agent kind of thing. I was glad that Z and Sebastian and the rest of TKO kind of carved out that space.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to see them do that with, again, kind of in that single issue format, because, I mean, especially with horror, like that is, there's such an industry built on the anthology series, and like even yourself have done that, and then you see that with yours and James Razorblades. Like that's kind of like, I think a lot of people think of horror in that sense, but then to be able to then take it and release, because all three of those shorts had a tinge of horror to them, I think, whether it was like Cosmic or Sebastian's was the but to able to have like a single issue dedicated to that. And I get, like you mentioned earlier, like the connotation of Z being kind of in Hollywood and now running a show, like it's so interesting because TKO, like none of their stuff feels like movie pitches or TV pitches. Obviously they all could work in that sense, but like it doesn't feel like kind of a lot of the Image stuff, where I think a lot of times you, like as a reader on the outside, you could feel like, oh, this kind of feels like a, you know, a pitch for a show or something like that. A lot of the Skybound stuff, but like this, it doesn't feel that way, but also like it is presented in some of the nicest way that comics have been presented, whether it's the collected issues in the hard box or the oversized trades they put out, or even these shorts are like beautiful, like glossy. And then I have the short fiction book, I'm blanking on her name, but that thing's amazing. The illustrations on it are great. That's like equally as creepy of a story. Like TKO continues to just be like really comics forward and presenting comics like as a beautiful medium and how, kind of how you want to read comics.
Yeah, and it's neat to me because I've actually been like a fully digital reader for about 5 years now. I really held out for a long time. It was like floppies only, but living in New York and having reduced space and not being able to carry stuff on the subway, once I got an iPad, I really committed to digital only. But then you do have publishers like TKO presenting this really nice physical artifact, and the shorts printing at the size they do, I think, like takes advantage of how short they are, because if you did that at a normal comic size, it would feel like you got like a free teaser or something. So doing this kind of like pamphlet size and shape does make them feel kind of like elevated zines almost. You know, no insult to zines by saying elevated, but I do think it's like it's cool to explore format. And as you mentioned, you know, James and I putting together Razorblades, part of that was also like exploring format and kind of playing with the bounds of that, because I think the more competitive the entertainment sphere in general gets, the more comics needs to offer either like novelty or accessibility. Like either it's got to be really easy to get it in an affordable way, or it's got to be something worth going out of your way to get. And I think TKO splits that balance really nicely.
Yeah, I wish I mean, I do the digital for a lot of the interviews and press stuff, but like, being buried in this office in physical comic media would be nice, but it's, again, especially with, how did, was it a kind of a team up with Lissandro?
Yeah. I didn't pitch with Lissandro. We reached out to him. So Sebastian and I made a short list of artists, and Lissandro was actually in the first set of names that I put forward because of Strange Skies Over East Berlin. I don't know if you read that book.
Yeah.
That Boom put out, but I thought it just had this lovely kind of like soft melancholy sense of creepiness to it. He does great work on Redneck at Skybound, but in some of his other books, it shows this eerier side of him. And in Night Train, I really wanted to hit eerie. Like eerie, unsettling, because it's not a very in-your-face story. It's more like it sits with you for a second, and when you kind of think through the implications of what's going on, and that can be hard to nail if the artist is more like action-forward.
Yeah,
It sounded like that was a comma, but that was a period.
That's it. Yeah, I think one of the best-selling moments of the short is that one page of him asleep and the parents finding out what he's doing, and like the transition of that, because obviously at that point you're going to be getting the third, not the third person narrative, but the overarching narrative from him, but visually the story is being told that way, and again it's action driven and kind of the emotion and the breakdown of everyone and being sold initially on that like first like relaxing image of him, but like, yeah, like it's such an eerie and kind of engrossing art form that he's done, especially on this is what happens when I have like a million, I guess I've had a million tabs over, Tim. Tim, this is what Patricio's colors on this, yes.
Yeah, Patricio, and then Steve Wands is the letterer. And yeah, everyone just, it was such a great team. And it's nice, you know, sometimes when you're putting something together piece by piece, you end up like someone can't do it, or they're just not available or not interested. So it was nice for Lissandro to be game right away and to be able to assemble. I feel like we were assembling the best possible team for the short and not like the most available possible team for the short.
Yeah, it feels like a pitch together short. Like this was like a passion project from people. And again, it's the I think to speak to kind of the script, but also Lissandro's ability to do that, and then obviously kind of the direction and editing of that you got at TKO. For you as someone who, like, I'm familiar with a lot of your stuff, especially kind of Razor Blades or kind of the shorter horror stuff, kind of working in that, and you seem to really kind of nail it, that one holiday horror, I think it's
called. We never really gave it a name, because it's really only three pages in like a send-off, but
yeah. But to be able to kind of like, and something me and Tim talk about, like, horror obviously is like one of our favorite things, and it's really difficult to pull off in comics, but more so kind of in the shorter narrative, because like I think effective horror comics really is about kind of involving people in the characters and really engrossing them, because like outside of that you don't have the ability to play with a lot of things like sound and visuals and pace. So like it's really about kind of investing them in it to push them in one direction or the other emotionally. So to be able to do that in like a short span is difficult, and I think again like horror's just like built for anthology, or just because of maybe how horror is maligned, a lot of times it's pushed in anthology. But for you, kind of who's kind of lived a lot in that, what is your approach to then kind of these shorter forms and being able to kind of hit the emotional beats that you want to hit in a story like this or any of them?
Yeah, well, the thing I love about short horror especially is that, you know, so much horror in comics, I feel, overstates its welcome. And that's no offense to any of my peers or other creators, but it is very hard to sustain scary over 30 issues, because what is mysterious and scary in issue one becomes less mysterious and less scary over time. And that's why you see a lot of longer running horror books kind of shift into sci-fi or like action-y, because it's just, it's hard to sustain that turn it up to 11 tension tone for a long time. And in shorts, you can kind of really get in and get out and just show like the most relevant part of your story. And the neat thing too about working in comics versus prose for that is that the artist is doing a lot of the heavy lifting to make you feel that relatability, to make you feel what you need to know about the character. So for instance, in the second issue of Razor Blades, I have a short with an artist named Michael Ramstead, and it's about like anxiety. So it's about mask anxiety, not in an anti-mask sense, but the uncanniness of not being able to read people the same way that we could just a year ago, not be able to see expressions the same way, not have a lot of the same visual cues that the vast majority of humanity grew up understanding. And so much of that is told, like, yeah, I have internal narration from the protagonist, but so much of it is told from the expressions that Michael gives him, the way he's dressed, the way he looks, the way the sweat starts to collect on his brow. So you're getting that empathy and you're getting that understanding and peek into who he is as a character visually without me having to even write that down on the finished page for you. And so that way you can just kind of cut right to the quick of the horror for the story and just do it in four pages and get in and get out. And that's why a lot of prose, I'm reading right now a collection called Song for the Unraveling of the World. I have it next to me, so I was able to read the title upside down, by an author named Brian Evanson. And a lot of the stories in the collection are like 7 or 8 pages. And he really drops you right into the moment before you need to be there and gets out as soon as he's done. It's very effective to me, and it's very interesting to me for horror especially. Because, yeah, I can't think of too many long-running horror series that I would consider particularly scary. They may still have scary visuals, you know, disturbing moments, but I don't think the scary is easy to keep around for a long time.
Yeah, I think, like, one of maybe my favorite, I think two favorite, just looking at my shelf, like, something either like Nailbiter or Harrow County are both ones that then kind of it's not like a suffer in the sense where the story gets worse or whatever, but the effectiveness of either the environment or the visuals lose that over, you know, 30 issues. Like, there's only so much you can do in that. You can still have those moments or again then really invest in the characters and do it that way, but to have like kind of unsettling sit with you moments is obviously so difficult to pull. I think of one of the scariest single issues I remember ever reading was Scott Snyder's Severed, the first issue.
Oh yeah,
like always stuck with me as the series progressed. I think it was 5 issues. Like,
I think 7.
It was less.
That was a longer one.
Oh Jesus. Yeah, like, so after that, like, it obviously is still good and the payoff is there, but it's not like that first issue where if that was that and you got to kind of that end moment where like that would have stuck with me forever. And that issue has the story has, I don't think I could tell you how the story ends otherwise, but like I could tell you all about that first issue.
Well, it's interesting too when you talk about it's so hard and sometimes it feels annoying to always compare comics to movies, but when you talk about a key difference in structure, especially for monthly comics, a horror movie, it may take 40 minutes to kind of ramp up. Like, you drop the sinister things here and there, that you get invested in the character, and then stuff all goes to hell. But a horror comic, you have to have that hook in the first issue to get someone to come back. You can't do, if it's a 5-issue series, it can't be 3 issues of building up the scare. You have to build up to the scare in the first issue or no one's going to buy the second issue. But then the trade-off is you get that sustainability problem where you can have first issues that kind of blow their load, and then the second issue, third issue, beyond, the impact is off. You know, like, I'm trying to think of, I was going to say Hereditary, but Hereditary has the head thing and everything in the beginning. But if you flip the structure of that movie around and, like, in the first half an hour, the whole cult stuff happens and people are floating and catching on fire, you know, it's going to be hard to keep that feeling up for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I think, yeah. And I think the beauty of Hereditary is one, like, they almost set you up for that with the marketing of that movie was like, oh, look at this creepy girl, and then halfway through,
not killer, even like, yeah, 15 and, like, minutes, yeah,
that is still like one of the most unsettling, like him just sitting in the car, we've talked about, like, it is like the perfect reaction, like, I don't know what I would just probably go up, but then that kind of primes you for everything else, and then when you get to that final moment and he catches on fire, like, it's like, oh fuck, like, this is not even what, this is what I thought it was going to be, and then you told me it wasn't, and then now we're at where I thought this movie was going to be, and it hits so much differently.
Yeah, and I'm not even the biggest fan, like, I have some major problems with that movie, but it's undeniably effective in scaring the shit out of people and shocking people. I mean, the head thing is one of the most shocking things I've seen in, like, a major released motion picture. But the thing I do love about that movie is all the family discomfort. And so I think there's definitely a sliver of that in Night Train that I wanted to pick up on, of just that, like, you know, family you are stuck with in so many ways, and especially as a kid. So you love your family if everything is okay. But you're stuck with them. And when you hate them, you're still stuck with them. When you're mad at them, you're still stuck with them. And especially in a claustrophobic space with these other extenuating circumstances going on, I really wanted to, even in 12 pages, kind of like sit in that tension a little bit.
Well, I think the maybe last 4 years have expressed the horror of a family and when you live with... I don't personally live, but I have lost, I don't even use Facebook, but I get, like, I'll get my mom, like, texting me, did you see what so-and-so posted on Facebook, or all of a sudden your aunt has unfriended you, Kyle. Like, I'm like, no. Okay.
Before we, I had a Night Train question. Which, version of Night Train is your favorite, the Guns N' Roses song, the James Brown song, or the Thomas the Tank Engine song?
Well, I can't think of any off the top of my head, so I'm gonna go with Thomas, because I was a big Thomas kid, and he is literally a train, so I feel like he should get the nod here. This was a working title that stuck, and I think it works for the book. But I would never say that titles are my strong suit.
Well, yeah, well, that's, if you want to know why we do a George Lopez intro, it's because I hate the title of this show, but after, like, 5 years and figuring out I can't just change the name because it fucks with, like, people finding it, is that... If anyone wants good Thomas music, as a dad, I can say there's... Once they switch to, like, the 3D stuff, at some point in their movies, they, like, hired, I don't know, somebody that writes these, like, crazy, like, rock songs, and they're, like, fucking great. They're awful, but, like, they're... It's like the guy who was writing all the Power Ranger songs, like, graduated and is, like, writing Thomas songs. So... And speaking of my kids, something to allude to, obviously, and it's something I'm insanely interested, not only because of kids, but we've talked about this again a bunch, is, like, I think for comics and the medium, the kind of young adults and kids market is not only huge market in the sense of, like, sales, like, obviously there's a shitload of sales, look at, like, Raina Tingeri, like, all that shit, but also, like, some of the best stuff I've read this past year and the past couple of years have come out of the young adult space, because I feel like there's way more freedom that those publishers are giving the creators, and they're also, it seems to be, they're finding at least a lot of the ones I've talked to recently on the show is, like, they are finding them and saying, like, we're interested in you as a creator. We think you do a good thing. Tell us a story and have us publish it versus, like, kind of them pitching it. And, like, so it seems like there's, like, an active push by the publishers, probably because of the sales. But if that's fine, like, that's
it doesn't hurt.
Yeah. for you, kind of, again, dipping, like, telling some of the most, like, horrific stories, like, I don't know if I might, because I am a terrible dad, but show my kids that Santa story. But doing that, and then kind of then being able to take the storytelling aspects that you do and kind of wrap that into the kind of young adult market, how does that change your writing style at all? Or does, like, the, what I'm also interested is, because, like, you seem to be able to write for several demographics, which even seems difficult, like the Grumpy Cat, the Golden book stuff is, like, you're specifically writing for a very young audience, but then to be able to then write a lot of your kind of more young adult teen stuff, like, that's a whole different mindset in itself again, and then to be able to jump more, like, how do you approach that as a writer, to kind of, you're writing to your audience per se?
Yeah, well, there's a Cher tweet from a couple of years ago that is, it just says, "What is happening to my career?" And there's no question mark at the end. And I quote that a lot, because when you look at everything I've done, what is happening to my career? I don't know. I just am kind of doing all of it. Because at this point,
career, man, I love your catalog.
At this point, I think the only age range I haven't specifically done is, like, true YA. So I used to work at Random House. I worked at Random House for 5 years in the children's division. And we would consider YA 12 plus. So I've done stuff on the border, but I don't think I've done something that would technically be 12 to 18. But otherwise, I've done, like you said, board books, beginning readers, junior novels. Just this morning, I signed a contract for a middle grade novel. I've done adult comics, and then I've done very adult comics. I just published Cheater Code, which is an erotica. So I have, like, any age range. I've got you from birth to 21.
That's good. That's where the money is. You gotta follow them. It's like R.L. Stein. Like, I got you as a kid. Here's these young adult books, and then I got movies for you. I got adult books. Like, just really drag them out.
Yeah, and honestly, that's part of the answer. It's like, earlier in my career, that's where I got a lot of opportunities, was to do more and more kid stuff. I worked with a fellow at Random House who wrote on the side, and luckily Random House had super flexible policies. Did not care whatsoever. We could write whatever we wanted someplace else, as long as we weren't doing it at our desk, which I often did anyway. But he had a child, and he was having trouble with a couple of his most pressing deadlines, so I ghostwrote for him. I take some small sliver of pride, and the first thing I ever had published was a Witchblade comic from Top Cow's Talent Hunt. And even though I wouldn't recommend this, I didn't share the script with anyone before I submitted it. I just did it myself, sent it in. So at least I, like, have the feeling of, okay, the first thing I did was just me, just merit, because I didn't know anyone there, or, you know, whatever passes for merit. But that's so senseless, because everything in publishing and everything in a lot of life is connections and who you know and the right mix of talent, adaptability, being polite, not being an asshole, etc. Anyway, I started helping him on some of his books, and then the same publisher started offering me stuff by myself, because he no longer had the time. He needed to take some time off while he raised his kid. And the nice thing about traditional publishing is that people leave one publisher to go to another publisher, and they keep their contacts. So I had people who worked at Random House who went to Little Brown, who went to HarperCollins, but still would offer me other opportunities. And I just kind of kept doing those alongside everything else in my career, because they're fun. They give me a chance to work on really big characters and licenses that I've loved my whole life. I mean, I've done like a dozen Nintendo books, and at this point, Nintendo has paid me more than I have ever spent on them, which is a nice feeling, and not a lot of 31-year-old nerds can say. And it's my, you know, I'm never going to get a chance to write a Pokemon adult novel about seriously journeying across Kanto, but I get to do Pokemon kids books and live in that world and have fun. And there's just a delight. And I do think you learn something when you have to refine a story down to it can only have this many syllables per line, it's 18 pages long, you know, you can't use contractions. You learn something about the, like, the economy of writing and how to fit a whole story in a smaller amount of space.
And I think it's something we've seen a lot, I think, recently in comics, is like a lot of the creators that we've enjoyed have kind of come from the, like, the anthology world, or people are starting out doing webcomics now and kind of focusing on those, like, short form, very concise and tight comics that are being then kind of springboarded into the bigger stuff. And it does, it really helps you be able to tell a coherent story versus, again, this like, again, not everyone's going to start out as Jonathan Hickman, and Jonathan Hickman didn't start out as Jonathan Hickman. He approached comics very singularly first and then built it out. And, like, I it's so interesting. And then I think it's a lot of times why I've enjoyed a lot of the young adult stuff that I've gotten into, again, because it is a lot of times taking these very singular stories that are approachable to any age range, but then also then condensing them, and then a lot of times I find the art, again, is a lot more creative and diverse in kind of the young adult. There's a lot more, like, watercolors and paint and stuff, which I enjoy, and again, you're not gonna see as much in kind of the Marvel and DC, but there really seems to be that range of kind of distinct storytelling, and then creators using that in kind of the springboarding into the more bigger stuff that helps. By that point, then I don't remember who this was, Tim. I think it was the last. I don't remember. My memory is fucking. Whether it's kids or COVID at this point, I can't remember anything. But, like, being able to tell a good story then helps you tell a good Spider-Man story. Because what makes a good Spider-Man story isn't Spider-Man per se. Like, he's just a dude. Like, being able to tell a good story about an interesting teenager, then you can tell a good, so anyone could tell a good Spider-Man story, but it doesn't necessarily, if your goal is to write Spider-Man or your goal is to do that, like, if that's your only, like, driving force, then you're not going to tell a good story.
Right, yeah. I mean, I would go so far as to say, like, that's probably actively hurting you if you're a prospective creator and what you want to do is tell your Spider-Man story or tell your X-Men story. Because if you're not drawing on other inspirations, if you're just kind of recirculating what's already there, if you don't have your own perspective or your own background or your own take on things, you know, Marvel's never going to extend that invite because they're full up. They've got Spider-Man stories. They don't need warmed over Spider-Man. And that's why you do get people like Hickman getting a chance to, you know, come in and really change the way superhero storytelling is done, or people like Bendis, even, you know, people forget because he's been in the industry for 20 years that he came in and on these, like, very different crime comics before he ever touched Spider-Man.
Yeah, he was drawing, same with Hickman, like, drawing their own stuff. And,
yeah,
again, not very, like, Hickman's, I mean, graphic design wise, and even Bendis, like, not very well. Like, they were good, they were passable, but, like, again, they understood the ability of storytelling and visual narrative and pushing that, and it all pays off. Kind of doing the licensing stuff, I mean, maybe even earlier, like, I know James, your partner, like, has worked a lot with Boom, and, like, how is it then kind of working in the younger market, but then having, like, it, can you make, like, what is, how do you tell a Grumpy Cat story? Like, is there a set outline, like, you're able to kind of work in, and then, or do they come to you and say, I want a story about Grumpy Cat going to bed, and then you're kind of working in that frame?
You know, it really does vary a lot. It changes so much license per license, and, you know, I don't want to talk out of school too much on some of the licenses I still work with, but you get a whole range from very protective licensors where, you know, you got to color in the lines, to licensors who are pretty flexible and pretty open to things. So for instance, like Transformers, I haven't worked with them in years, and, you know, that's not necessarily on the horizon for me. But I remember the first junior novel I turned in for them, one of the notes I got back was that Optimus Prime can't sit, which like it's just you know no one would read that and think, oh my god, he sat, this is terrible, like we need to update the wiki because Optimus did sit. But you know, that's a licensor's job, is to protect their license, and I get it. But I've been very lucky too to have some very fun books. So for Grumpy Cat, I did get the offer of Grumpy Cat Bedtime, and from there it was my job to come up with what a Grumpy Cat bedtime story is. And then there are other times, like some of the books I've done are episode adaptations, so I already know the story, and it's my job to take a 30-minute cartoon and make it work as like a 16-page book for kids. So it really varies. I wish I could talk about one of the things I have coming out this fall, because it's definitely the biggest licensed project I've ever done, but it hasn't been announced yet. And that, I was blown away by how much I got away with. I'll tell you after you stop recording. But I was very pleasantly surprised. Biggest license I've ever worked with, but the most freedom I've ever had to tell my own story within that. So that was a lot of fun to do.
No, it's great.
And I think the properties that seem to kind of work and then transcend are the ones that were... is it seems like, from what we talked to, and again, I'm going to press... Like Turtles, they seem to be open to like doing anything you want. You want to pull from whatever, and like, so at that point you're kind of been able to, like, those creators have really been able to kind of grow a unique and different story. Yeah, but now I'm currently reading the Transformers manga they put out.
Oh.
And they're like the reprints from, I don't know if it's like the 70s, right? Like, they're goofy as fuck. Like, they're the best thing ever. He's got to sit in that. Like, he like is kicking, like,
I refuse to believe I was the first person to try to get Optimus Prime to sit down.
Like, maybe that's the thing. Maybe everyone tries to get him to sit down, and they're just like, enough. Like, he's always fucking sitting.
But the flip side is I made up some brand new Transformers that then got wiki entries for appearing in one kid's book ever. So I guess, you know, good for like the Abominable Snowman one I made up and whoever else.
I will say, like, the horror chops of being able to put one of the scariest images of Grumpy Cat still.
Oh my god, I love, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. That was so funny to me. That illustrator is great, and I think I said in the script that this is basically like a Batman shot. Oh wait, do you mean the bathroom?
No, the one where he's, it says like, I prefer the darkness.
Yes, so that was a Batman joke. But there's also like, she closes, the other cat closes the mirror and Grumpy Cat's behind her. Which was like my little like horror movie note. So I guess I do just kind of try to put horror everywhere.
I was interested in, you had mentioned earlier, and again, that's like just mentioning you edit on like one of, again, another best books of the year, but The Department of Truth. What is, for someone who's kind of done a lot of different roles, editing and again, kind of writing for pace, and then also doing a lot of the, you know, multiple tiers of writing age groups and stories and longer narratives, shorter narratives, going to editing, what is that like? Is that helpful as a writer to then be able to kind of take what you notice in other things, or is it as a writer then to kind of take what you know as a writer, what has worked for you, and kind of adapt that into the editing world as well?
Editing Department of Truth is like the platonic ideal experience for editing a comic book. Because like I said, I was an editor at Random House. I was an editor at Pace Magazine. And I'm actually a freelance editor at First Second. So I work on kids books, kids comics for them as well.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, they do the best stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I've been doing that for about a year, and I haven't really spoken too much about it publicly because books take so long in the traditional book market that the stuff I've worked on hasn't come out yet. So I've talked about it on podcasts, but I haven't really tweeted about it or anything else. But it's no secret. Working with James and Martin and Aditya and Dylan on Department of Truth is a great experience. It's a very informative experience because I do feel like I'm constantly learning from every person in the team. I think a possible pitfall of being a writer editor is that your job as an editor is not to say, this is how you should do it, this is how you do it better, this is how I would do it. It's to prompt the person you're editing or the people you're editing to figure out their own best version of a story. So my job is not to write over James. Obviously, James is extremely qualified, has published much more than I have. But my job is to be a sounding board for James and to point out things that he's not noticing because he's writing five books or because, you know, it's just a tough week or whatever. And it's to have those conversations with him. And it works out great with James because he and I are similar ages. We draw on so many of the similar things we grew up with. You know, earlier today, we were both tweeting about Final Fantasy VIII. Like, just from silly things to very serious connections, we share so much of a baseline knowledge and a baseline passion. So he and I are texting back and forth constantly, emailing back and forth constantly, making a book. On the scale of Department of Truth is like an around the clock job. It's not like you clock in and clock out. But it's such a pleasant experience because James and I get along the way we do. And as I'm editing him and as I'm helping him tell the best James story possible, I'm also seeing what makes James' story so successful and what makes him so popular. And that is helpful for me then as a writer.
Yeah, because then you can just copy what he does so you can get a success.
Yeah, I mean, check out my book, Some Things Are Murdering the Young People. Completely original idea.
For a book like Department of Truth, where I have to imagine, like, on James' end, there is, even Martin's end, like, there's a large amount of research that goes in or kind of understanding that world and a lot of the topics they're talking about. As an editor, that's something you have to do as well, as like kind of engross yourself in the subject matter, or does it help to not to then be able to kind of focus more on kind of like the storytelling aspects or kind of the cohesiveness of what he's trying to then push through a narrative?
I definitely haven't gone as deep into the rabbit hole as James has, but I have joked that we have all certainly been flagged for internet searches that we've conducted in the course of making this book. Who knows if we can even fly anymore? But it is helpful to enmesh myself in it as much as possible. And thankfully, these are all things that interest me. When James first gave me the outline, which extends, you know, quite a bit past what readers have been able to read, so many of these are topics that I already found fascinating. And this prompted me to take my own deep dive. So there are things I've read that James and Martin haven't that I recommend them, or I send James links all the time of like, oh my God, look at this fucked up thing that happened. And especially with a book like this, you know, we started working on it, or I came in midway through 2019. Martin, James, Aditya, and Dylan had already started working, but there were no sequential pages yet. It was, everything was approved to Image, but the book had not started in proper. And in the time from 2019 just to mid 2020, when we got announced, so many of the conspiracy theories we were talking about had become like mainstream accepted nonsense by half of the country. So I think I tweeted one day, like, can we all make this book less relevant? Like, I'm very happy that it's successful, but I would like it to reflect the real world less than it does.
I know. It's this. The last 4 years have ruined the fun of conspiracy theories.
That's what, I mean, we were genuinely concerned, like, is this going to be too breaking news for people, even though we started this so long ago? But obviously and thankfully, the response has been so great.
I imagine, like, I can imagine giving notes. I don't know if that says an air job to Martin. Like, this is too good. If you could make this not as good, it'd be helpful.
There have been little moments, and like, for instance, we had a script that said something about Donald Trump in the present tense, and we got to change it to the past tense, and that was nice because we were editing it over the course of November. So there are times where, like, the real world kind of catches up to what's going on in the book, but thankfully we've been able to toe the line so far. And actually, without giving anything away, as we move into our two guest issues and into the second arc, I think we're going to be dealing with some concepts that, let's just say, I'll be surprised if they're in national news this year. But yeah, surprised and horrified if they become national news this year. I guess I'm not ruling anything out in 2021.
Yeah. After the sixth, I'm not sure. I was like, well, we've gone. We've gone full movie at this point. So, I have some questions about paste. More just
sure,
like,
yeah.
Picking your brain. But so I don't know if Tim had any questions comic related before. Just go down tangents.
No, you kind of covered how he can write for, like, all different demographics, which kind of blew up my joke about bringing up the children's books and then asking if he's going to learn how to write more than, like, a second grade level, but we won't go there.
I was going to say earlier, you know, talking about you were talking about kind of the range that's possible in children's publishing that you don't necessarily get in adult publishing. And I am very grateful for that. So I have a couple projects coming up in the children's world that haven't been announced yet. But it is nice to be able to work on that kind of schedule and to not have to worry about that, like, okay, this is going primarily to the direct market. It's going to be relevant for a month. We have to get people hooked or we're not going to be able to finish the story. It's nice to have, like, the full production process of a book and to have, you know, 18 months to put something together and focus on it and have, like, a publicity and marketing team and all these other things. So I do think it's great that that side of the market has evolved over the last few years. And even when I was at Random House, that was already kind of the ball was rolling because of Raina and other creators. So I am super excited to see that changing and growing. But I love the direct market too, and I think it's cool that we're seeing a little more experimentation, whether it's like TKO or something like Future State doing anthologies, whatever. I think it's an interesting and fun moment for the industry. So I didn't want to sound too dismissive earlier when we were talking mostly about kids comics.
Oh no. And I think I know last year alone we did the Daughters of Yes. I'd read the the Hardy Boys type one. Oh, the Montag twins. And they were again, like, some of, like, if not my favorite books of the year. Like, it was a lot of fun. And I even think of, like, you know, Emily Carroll's book, like, those, they have them put in the young adults section. I think it's the young adult fan, and, like, those are some of the most fucked up books out there. And, like, again, broken record to anyone who's is listened to. It's not a I always say bringing it up, but it's, like, so relevant to the cast. But I do occasionally work at Barnes & Noble, and, like, that is, like, the most popular sections are young adult fiction, fantasy, and then the manga section. I was trying to, like, reorganize the manga section this past weekend, and it took me all fucking day because there's so many goddamn kids in there. And then, like, which is awesome, but then also, like, I feel like a fucking creep because, like, there was, like, teenagers. Like, the kid was, like, 15 or 16. He was, like, with his girlfriend, and they were talking about stuff. And I was like, oh, hey, he was, like, looking for, like, first volumes. I was like, oh, hey, have you read Gundam? It's, like, the best one. You should read Gundam. And I was like, here's the stuff. And then I saw he put it back, and I was like, fuck that kid.
But that, you know, the Emily Carroll point is great because I do, like, I know you wanted to ask about pace and stuff too.
Oh, no,
but, you know, I have a pro friend who I won't name, but he's prolific at the Big Two and Image and other publishers. And he is working on YA, and he has all these questions for me, and he treats it like it's such a foreign concept, but it it is not. Like, you know, it's a good story is a good story. And all you're really putting out of your storytelling toolbox with YA is, like, graphic sex, on-panel drug use, hard drug use, and, like, too many F-bombs. You know, it's not like it's this massively different world. And just like manga, YA and middle grade have such a wealth and depth of genres and stories that they can tell. So it's no surprise that they're popular to me, and something like Emily Carroll can sit, you know, a couple shelves away from Raina Telgemeier, from Noelle Stevenson, from, you know, Dave Pilkey, whoever, because kids are more open-minded in general as readers, I think, and they're willing to suspend disbelief a little more. And also, like, if you think back to being a kid, you know, you want to read it all and you don't want to feel like it's being softball pitched to you. Like, I was 12, 13, something, if it felt like it was talking down to me, I wanted nothing to do with it. And that's why it's, like, such a cool no man's land in a lot of ways, or anything goes land in a lot of ways, because kids do want it all. Like, they want the edgy stuff, they want the fun stuff, they want the funny stuff, and they're not going to be like, well, Green Lantern's ring was on the wrong hand. You know, it's like, they just don't have the same blocks that a lot of adult readers have. You know, it's not going to be like, well, this contradicts an issue I read when I was 14. You know, it's like, you just open yourself up to, like, a fun range of what you can do in comics when you work in the kids' sphere.
Yeah. And those kids that do are the kids that become, like, Ben Shapiro. But, well, and it's, it's, and it's so weird. Like, it's almost like something that, like, is continually forgotten by, I don't know, maybe they're adults, or as people get older, or the people kind of take break, like, because if you look at anything, like, even like early comics, like, people like, there's such, like, a claim for the, like, the Don Rosa Scrooge McDuck stuff. Oh, yeah. And like even, like, I've been reading I've been collecting the Fantagraphics Peanuts stuff recently, and, like, again, it's like, it's depressing, it's, like, existential. And, like, even something like the Flintstones, which became, like, a phenomenon, it wasn't because adults, like, it ran at an adult time. I think it ran at, like, 8 o'clock at night. It became popular because kids were looking for a more adult show to watch at a cartoon. Same with Simpsons. Like, Simpsons grew in popularity not because of adults. I mean, that helped, but, like, it was because kids, like, clomped onto it because they were looking for something that wasn't talking down to them. And even, like, you know, the rise of, I think, kids' cartoons now is because people have adopted sequential storytelling in cartoons and stuff like that. And really, like, again, like, and that's a joke, like, but, like, with my kids, a lot of times is, like, kind of being able to grasp. Obviously, you want to treat kids like kids. Like, I mean, I'm not going to, like, show them Alien or something, even though one of them's named after a character from Alien. But, like, also, like, I also don't want, like, to talk down to them. They're little people. Like, they're little people who have little people thoughts and stuff like that. So it is, like, a being able to, like, navigate that. But kids, like, kids want, like, smart and, like, layered things. It's, I think a lot of times people, as people get older, they forget, like, what it was like to be a kid and really want those type of things. And those are the things that kids really navigate towards.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Kids want to be scared, they want to be sad, they want to be excited, they want to be thrilled. It is this funny, like, disappearing act we do in our brain, where as we get older, we go from, like, being these boundary pushing kids to wanting to protect the next generation of kids and forgetting entirely what it was like to be a kid. So I think it's like, I guess I started publishing for kids when I was, like, 25, so relatively young. And I, you know, I could still, teen years are not that long ago from 25. And it's like, you know, you want the edgy stuff. You want to feel like you're reading something you shouldn't, or that is at least, like, pushing your expectations a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, the quintessential edgelords are teens. But, the stuff I had to prepare, I'm always interested in, kind of the creators that are also kind of working in the realm of also covering, and, like you mentioned, doing interviews and stuff like that. How does it doing kind of both sides for our time and kind of being able and someone who's also writing and interviewing, is there, is, I don't say there's like a hesitance, because obviously that's not like something you think about, like, but is there kind of like, you
know, no, there is. Yeah. I mean, like, I'll speak candidly. I had a great experience at Pace, and I'm thankful for Josh Jackson and everyone else there. But I've been gone for a couple of years now. They closed the vertical, so I don't have any qualms with speaking honestly. It is hard to balance, because you can kind of give yourself imposter syndrome, where you're like, am I a creator or am I a wannabe creator? Like, am I doing this press stuff to try to sneak my way in? Does this make me less valid as a creator? And I never did reviews. Like, that was a hard line for me when I started, mm-hmm. because if I wanted to see these people as peers, I couldn't be critiquing them fairly. You know, I can't say like, oh, so-and-so sucks, and then the next week be pitching to write a book in the same line as that person. So it was hard. I think it was a balancing beam that was useful to walk for a little while, but when they closed the vertical, I definitely took it as like a pushing a baby bird out of the nest moment, where I was like, okay, well, I'm fully freelance at this point. I just need to commit my all into my writing side of life and make that the entirety of my attention span. Because the other drawback, you know, I was making decent money at Paste. I was a freelance editor, so I wasn't full-time, but they were pretty generous, which is probably why they had to close it eventually. but the trade-off for that expected money every month was that every single day, because we were just a team of four writers. One of them was pretty infrequent, I was doing multiple articles, and every article I posted and formatted and put on the site was an hour or two that I wasn't writing my own stuff. So I don't begrudge anyone or think it's a bad path if you're working in press or you're working in editorial with the ultimate goal of being a writer and only a writer, but you are always doing that calculus of, am I learning something from this? Am I gaining something from this? Or is this ultimately prolonging the path I want to be on? But I can also, like, I met so many people as a result of that, so many creators that I'm now friends with, that I've worked with in Razor Blades, that have recommended me for jobs. So by approaching it normally and not trying to go out of my way to be like, okay, well, let's stay friends because you're writing this book I'd love to write, I think friendships and connections evolved organically that I can appreciate in retrospect.
Yeah, it's, and it makes it awkward because this was all a play for me intended to pitch you. Yeah, and that's like when I kind of switched over to just interviews, part of it was like the losing interest in doing the reviews, because that's all like when you're starting out, people want, like, because nobody wants to do them, and yeah, like, exactly. Also, there's a million things to review, and like, those are generally, I don't know if that's what gets, apparently that's what gets like clicks, but I someone who's read comics almost all my life, I don't think I've read maybe like 5 reviews outside of research for interviews. Also, like, I would do reviews, and it would always be that like type of, like, I would never like, and the whole idea of starting the podcast was frustration with reviews that were like, this book sucks. Like, well, that's not that's not a critique. Like, that's not a, like, obviously a lot of work went into this book. There's, and it was, I remember it being Sex Criminals. That's
the Fraction Zdarsky book.
Yeah,
Zdarsky.
Doing that review, and it took me forever because I was like, I didn't like the book. I didn't like it, but I was cognizant and well aware of how well written it was, how beautiful it looked. It was just, for whatever reason, it didn't, you know, it didn't sit with me. It didn't, like, I wasn't interested in the second issue, but I could tell it was a good first issue. And I was like, I don't know how to write this in a review, so it just turned into like, you know, this might be for the people that enjoy this. It wasn't for me. Here's why it's good. Here's what didn't work with me. And I was like, this is a really boring review because, like, no one cares about this. They just wanted, like, me to be like, oh, this art sucks. So I that's why switching over to interviews of things that I enjoy and Tim enjoys, and like that's way more fun and interesting.
Yeah, well, it's also, it was sobering to see the analytics side of Paste, because, you know, not to toot my own horn, but I think while we existed, we were a good outlet, because, you know, we ran almost no reviews. We tried to do more in-depth features and try to approach things creatively. And the guy who was editor before me, Sean Edgar, you know, he tried to do the same. We ran original comics on the site and all this other stuff. But, you know, the stuff that got clicks was the most basic. Like, either it was an outrage article or an article about something controversial or, like, a list. And it became a little, like, soul-deadening over time to see that the stuff that I love to do and the stuff that creators really enjoyed doing with us got no clicks. But, like, you know, top 10 Storm outfits or whatever, which we never ran, but obviously, you know, you immediately thought of the site I'm thinking of when I said that, you know, that outdoes our traffic by like 500%. So it was sobering. And that's actually one of the reasons I love like that podcasts have become more of a thing, because it is fun to get to talk about things more in depth, and you kind of like self-select, like no one's going to click on this if they aren't somewhat interested in who I am or they read Night Train or whatever. But at least once you have listeners in, you know that they're like interested in what's going on, and you don't have to like Steve Fox's favorite Storm outfits or you know whatever. I like her current one. That would be number one for me right now.
And I mean, at least with my hope has always been like, again, being a very, every episode is a book that we book or creator or runs of things we generally love and are like, not something where we're just like taking requests for interview. Like we will always take requests, but it's not something where like we're going to do interviews for things that we aren't generally interested in. Because also like you said, like doing an interview show where every episode is a different creator, like limits a lot of times the listener base. And I know that, and I've talked to creators who like actually listen to the show, but they'll say like, you know, I only listen to ones where like, you know, it's a book I like or a creator I like. But because of that, we try and be as genuine as possible, because then like, hopefully like, okay, like I align with Tim and Kyle's interests. Like they talk a lot of like the books I like, so they may branch out and listen to, like, I've never read anything by Steve, but like, you know, those guys like it. And we've had like the cool thing that has happened of doing the show is the, it's still, I think it's like our header is someone listening to the Al Gaffa interview and saying they went out and bought the book because of that. Obviously they should, because like if you look at Al Gaffa's work, it's fucking amazing. But like if that's something like you listen to us and like, oh, those guys have okay taste, like that's fucking awesome. You mentioned lists, and that was my thing. You have two lists on there, and the best horror, I think it's of all time, and 25 best. What, like, Tim probably has better insight because he works directly on sites, but like, it says Steve and people. Was that something where it was Steve and people, or was it Steve doing all of it and coming up with, and how difficult was it to rank 50 of the best horror?
No, I mean, those genuinely are real people, the other people who are credited with some of those blurbs, but we used to try... But that's Steve
tracking people down to get those blurbs.
Yes, and sometimes it was like, okay, someone wrote about, you know, The Stand 3 years ago on Paste. Oh. Can I pull three sentences out of that so I don't have to write a blurb? A lot of, like, repurposing existing content, for sure. So would I take any of those as the gospel truth rankings? No, probably not. Those were like what we had assets for and what I thought was good enough to attach my name to at the time. I'd probably revise some of those now. But, you know, those are like the things that did the absolute most traffic. Top 50 horror books or whatever, that probably, you know, quote unquote, paid for like months of creator interviews. Because when you Googled best horror comics, that list would always come up. The funniest one to me was when I first started contributing to Paste, I did like some little top 10 Junji Ito panels. I mean, talk about like pulling something out of your ass. But that for years was always in the top five traffic, because if you Googled Junji Ito before Viz really started importing more of his stuff, that list always came up in the top five results.
And it's all from Junji Ito and his cat.
One of the cats in there.
Yeah. Well, I will say you have The Fisherman as number one.
Oh, yeah, I do love The Fisherman.
Oh, shit. I know we were talking earlier about, like, effective horror. But that's, like, it's, like, one of the, like it sneaks up on you when you're reading it. And, like, I've never, like, the cliche of, like, not wanting to put a book down. I was like, holy shit. And I just, like, sat through and read that thing in, like, two nights.
I was going to say, I think I read that in, like, two sittings, because it's not that long either.
Yeah.
The ranked lists I will stand behind better than the unranked ones. If it was alphabetical, spoiler alert, we just need to fill space. If it was ranked, I probably actually felt that way.
I think, yeah. I know you have stuff you want to talk about. Like, if people want to find more about you or follow you or find out when they can get more stuff, what's the best way they could do that?
SteveFox.com is my website that lists all of the varied things I do. And I'm also on Twitter at Steve_Fox, F-O-X-E. And then the next thing I would point people to is issue 3 of Razor Blades, the horror anthology I do with James Tynan. Comes out later this month. I think we're going to launch it on the 25th. We're trying to put some space between us and the inauguration, just in case. Just, you know, what a normal thing to have to plan for. But that issue 3 comes out, and that's the next best place to find me. I'm launching a serial story in this one. So I had standalone short stories in issue 1 and issue 2. And in issue 3, I have a teaser for a story that will run in issue 4 and issue 5, and then hopefully be coming to a different format later down the line.
Yeah, if you're at all interested in horror, Razor Blades is like the quintessential, like the type of stuff that I think horror was kind of born out of. That I always think of, like, you know, creepy or anything like that, and it's so good. And the wide range of stuff, obviously, with comics and prose and just some illustration in there is fantastic.
Yeah, and to put a kind of like tie up with a neat bow is one of the things James and I really wanted to do with Razor Blades was bring people from different worlds together under one roof. So we have people who are better known for YA. Tilly Walden is in issue 3, who's so best known for like YA comics. We have horror illustrators who've never published in print before but have huge followings on Twitter. One of my favorite novels of last year, I ended up inviting him to write a short story, and that's going to come out in issue 4. So it really is about bringing together like a mixed range of people and taking advantage of that full market of horror storytelling that exists right now and putting it all in one spot. And readers can find that at readrazorblades.com. The print issue will go on sale later this month, and then every issue is available digitally for whatever cost you want to pay. So if you want to give us $5, awesome. If you want to get it for $0, that's an option, because we just want to get this out in front of people.
But yeah, I mean, zero, it's so good, it's so beautiful. And those like cover images alone are worth a few dollars. Again, before me and Zin do our quick stuff, which again we talked about as comic book podcast people, we're not good at in general. But I know we talked about kind of a wide range of stuff, but kind of everything Steve has out there is fantastic on every level. You had mentioned when I had reached out the Adventure Kingdom stuff. I was aware of it. I hadn't read it, and you sent it to us. And I blew through the first like 4 issues yesterday. It's a lot of fun. And again, the ability to kind of navigate all those realms, those different themes and genres, and to do it all extremely well. And then also to have a book my kid enjoys with Grumpy Cat is fantastic. So like I said, anything you can get with Steve stuff is great. Not great stuff. Tim, where can you find?
You can find me. I write over at Comics Pit. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Tim Madera, and you can likely find me at home rooting for the Bruins now hockey's back.
Yeah. Tim's got a Storm ranking going up later today.
Well, you know, now that I made fun of it, I am thinking how I would rank the costume. So I guess I played myself.
Mohawk Storm, downside. Always number one.
No, that's the downside. It is like the... Every time I have an obsession with... I would love just a site where I rank the CBR rank list. Like, I'm just so obsessed with them. I will spend hours looking through this, like how many they publish a day. But then occasionally I'll read them and I'll be like, oh, I don't know about that. I don't know about
that. They got you, gal.
Fuck me. And I will suggest if anyone has time to go look through them, because there are a few people who are well aware of how silly the lists are, and they seem to get away with, because I don't know if editors actually read them, they're able to get away with some funny things on them. We are at pages_panels, like we talked about. You didn't randomly stumble upon this podcast, but if you did, we're there. And now everything, you can find us at anchor.fm/pages and panels. You can listen to us up there, rate, subscribe, I don't know. But also it links to any of the normal stuff, Spotify, all that jazz we're on now. I think we were before, but now for sure I know, because Anchor has set that all up for me, which I wasn't aware you could do. But outside that, my last question. Tim, we forgot your... God damn it, Tim. No, we have two last questions. Tim, what was your last question? Shit, Tim,
well, you gotta... I didn't know if we were retiring it, because we changed it for David last episode.
Do you want to do the new question? Let's do the new one.
The new one? Yeah. All right, so...
Is this about the George Lopez show?
No. It's more... It's higher brow. It's higher brow than that.
Yeah, Steve, gun to your head. If you had to write an episode of 2.5 Men, what would happen?
Oh my God. I think Charlie Sheen would actually turn into a tiger and eat the kid. Am I thinking of the right show?
Yes.
Yeah, that's
okay. The right, I think he would eat the kid. And it would be a metaphor, obviously, for, you know, the struggles of fatherhood and all those great things. I don't know what the other guy's doing during this. I think he is attracted to the tiger. If this shows up in a story of mine in a year or two, just know that I retain all rights.
Yeah, we were doing... You're the first official. We had, for last year, all of 2020, we asked Big Bang Theory, but we had a returning guest. So we... Tim Smiley did 2.5 Men, and I am much more... I'm now interested in 2.5 Men fanfic. But, yeah, again, I can't... Oh, what was my last question? Yeah, do you get to pick the stickers they put at the end of the reader books?
No, God, I wish I did. You know, they usually, like, a licensor will...
Because they use the images in the book. At least usually it's similar art to what appears in the book.
Well, yeah, because here, you know, peek behind the curtain, usually a licensor gives you the art you can use up front, and then you just have to make it work. So... A lot of those books, they aren't commissioning new art. It's what they have. But man, I'm that guy who like never wants to use the stickers because I'm saving them for a theoretical time in the future.
Yep. I get so annoyed that my kids use them in there. And I always try and like, he'll put them on his, like, the second he reads it, he puts it on his bed. And I'm like, well, you're not going to have that bed forever. Like, why don't we put it? We could just keep them and store them in a book. And he's like, for what? And I was like, I don't know. Forever. We'll bury you with them.
Yeah, I walked into a bookstore when my first Mario sticker book came out. Because I just, like, you know, you want to see your book on a shelf. And a kid was just sitting there in the bookstore taking the stickers out and putting them on the furniture in the bookstore. Which I wish I'd gotten a video of. Yeah. As a very unique author experience.
If you want to chart days like childhood dies, is one of the days, like my childhood slowly died, was when I like realized that, like Power Rangers, they have the like the, what do they call it? Like the stock images.
Oh yeah.
That they use, and like they just reuse them for different things, and I was like slowly realizing, I was like, well, I see that like Trini pose a lot in this stuff. And I was like, wait a second, I'm like going through stuff. It was like me discovering this like small conspiracy theory. I was like, oh shit, all right, well, yeah. Santa's not real.
I was about to make the same joke. Santa's not real, and they probably gave that author 7 poses to use.
But yes, you can get your, what is that? That's the cat. Oh, what is that one? Copycat?
Oh yeah, Copycat. So that's a Batman step into reading with all original art that was commissioned for the book.
And 30 stickers. But yes, pick that up. Or like I said, Night Train, easily one of my top 10 books of last year. It was fantastic. And to be able to kind of pull that off, the short thing is nothing but amazing. So thank you so much again for joining us and dealing with all our dumb questions. Hopefully it wasn't terrible. And I promise next time, Tim, we will get to George Lopez. I know I keep telling you that. We've been a whole year and a half now at this point. We're not getting there, but we'll get there.
I'm jonesing for it. I'm ready.
I know. I'm just waiting for the day Tim does not show up because he's fed up with it. But thank you so much for joining us.